will see support for small businesses in the form of SBA loans, and people should pursue those.
I have been in touch with a number of our students. We extended our spring break for all students to this week.
It's difficult to make logical decisions for ourselves when we're not quite sure where it is that we're going.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode, what else? More on the coronavirus pandemic. Let's get right to it. I spoke with New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, a Democrat from the 18th District, on Wednesday afternoon about the coronavirus and how the federal government is responding.
Well, there's two large areas of response. The first and most important is combating the spread of the virus and protecting people. There are a lot of efforts underway. The House has passed an $8 billion package that will address issues of protective equipment for first responders, things like making sure testing is more widespread and free of charge, making sure that the path to a vaccine is shortened, all the things that are necessary to fund our response to the crisis. We are also working on a massive economic stimulus package to address the economic impact with a focus on speeding relief to individuals and small businesses that need it right now. And that will happen over the next few days.
What's your message to those small businesses where maybe they've had to lay staff off? I mean, we know restaurants, bars, and pretty much anywhere people gather is now closed. They may be hearing that a bill is coming down the pike, but have their own bills to pay in the meantime.
Right. Well, my message is, hang on, help is on the way. There will absolutely be relief coming. It will take a number of forms. I think you will see quick, direct cash payments to individuals, which will help everybody, and focused on people who are, you know, working families and middle-income people. You will see support for small businesses in the form of SBA loans, and people should pursue those forms of relief right now in the most heavily affected areas. They can start that process right now. I think you'll see support for things like expanded unemployment benefits for folks who've been laid off or lost a job. We've seen a big increase in claims, and we will be supporting those and making sure the benefits are as generous as needed. My message is, if people can keep their employees to the maximum extent possible, we're hoping to avoid layoffs, and the federal government will be responding with a massive economic support package that is going to be directed at helping people who need it most.
An idea has gotten some traction, which is to send Americans a $1,000 check, effectively. Cut them a check right now to stimulate the economy. Is that a good idea?
It is a good idea, and I think you'll see it happen. And I want to make sure it's focused on the people who need it most. But it is an efficient and really meaningful way to help people who are struggling. But there are other things we can do. We can suspend the tax payments people would otherwise need to make for months. We're doing that. We can guarantee that no one has their utilities shut off. We're doing that. We can make sure that there are no evictions or foreclosures during this period of crisis. We're doing that. There are a variety of ways we can give some confidence to moms and dads and people who are at home with the kids that they're going to be able to pay their bills, keep a roof over their head, feed their family, and that is where the focus is.
As usual, there's some dissonance between the president and the people who work for him closely on the issue of the economy. But his top economic official says that recession is looking pretty likely right now, given this crisis. What do you think the long-term outlook is now?
I think this is an unprecedented short-term crisis, and it matters a lot what we do right now. I think what is different, and in some ways more hopeful, is that the nature of a pandemic is that it comes on with extraordinary speed, and we are feeling the effects of that now in our public health system and also economically. But it also can have a duration that is shorter than some of the crises we've seen in the past. So, for example, in the Great Recession, we had structural problems with our housing industry, with our financial services industry, and those took years to work themselves through, and it took down the economy with it. You know, with 9/11, we were obviously facing an unprecedented situation with an attack on the United States, a war that followed really 20 years of war that has followed, and a change to the way we live that has never gone back to the way it was before. These crises are different than what we're experiencing right now. This is unprecedented in terms of its scale and the comprehensive way it's affecting all families, and that's a direct hit on our economy. But we have every reason to believe that if we can bridge this gap, help families get through this period of crisis, that the economic recovery can be much sooner and much stronger than in previous economic crises. And that's because when the worst of the pandemic is behind us, and we know what we're dealing with, and we've got effective vaccines in the pipeline, and we've developed a lot of immunity in the population, we are going to be able to resume our lives pretty much as before. We ought to be more prepared for the next time this happens, and there's a lot of lessons to learn. And there's an enormous, enormous challenge right now in protecting the most vulnerable people and keeping human suffering and loss of life to a minimum. But in terms of the economy, my focus at the federal level is having a massive stimulus package that will bridge this gap until the economy can recover. But I don't expect that will be years and years. I think it could be a matter of months to a year if we make the right decisions now. And, of course, we have to focus on families who need it most. We've also got to learn some of the mistakes of the past to make sure that this economic help isn't lying in people's pockets who don't need help.
To that end, I mean, a lot of your colleagues are saying, let's be very careful here about the industries that are bailed out as part of this, specifically the airline industry, other industries that the president says he's speaking with. Are there any people on your list who you think, you know, should be left off of this particular stimulus?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of patience for companies that are not U.S. companies, that don't pay U.S. taxes, beyond helping their employees. That there are industries that will be affected by this that have chosen to benefit by domiciling overseas or by hiring foreign workers. Our focus needs to be on American workers and on American companies that have been playing by the rules. And even when we do, we need to make sure that the help goes to working people, not to executives, not to stock buybacks, not to bonuses, not to the kind of game playing we saw in certain industries where, despite having been bailed out, they subsequently use the protection of bankruptcy to undermine people's pensions or to take away their equity interest, their stock options. We have learned some lessons from the past, and a bunch of us are going to be laser-focused on making sure that no one's going to be taking advantage of an economic package with people's tax dollars that is meant to bridge this gap. Bear in mind, by the way, that we can structure this relief in ways that the taxpayers will make money off of in the end. There are good examples of that too. I mean, nobody really knows this, but if you look at some of the bailouts from 10 years ago, you can take stock equity in private companies that you know are going to recover. You can do so at very low prices, and when those companies recover, you can sell that equity position at a profit and make money for the taxpayers. So if we do this right, we can save these industries, support the workers, most importantly, get through the crisis, and make money for the taxpayers on the back end. That's the smart way to do it.
Let me ask you about the state response and your role in that. Governor Cuomo has been sort of desperately looking for more hospital beds, more facilities where beds can be established, more ventilator equipment, things along those lines. Does New York's 18th District have anything to offer toward that end?
Well, I spoke to the governor yesterday about just this. We have been discussing, and I want to thank the governor. He's been extraordinary. I think anybody who's watching must realize that he has been truly exceptional in his response. He's been proactive and aggressive. And yes, I mean, we have local facilities and capacity and things like Stewart Airport and things like local facilities that could be used for surge hospital capacity. We're outside the eye of the storm and therefore could be an area where people are relocated if they need hospitalization when there isn't enough capacity elsewhere. We are here to help. We are obviously worried about, you know, our neighbors locally. We are doing pretty well in terms of the number of confirmed cases. We're just seeing the testing really ramp up now, and we're seeing the cases tick up along with that. But so far, we have avoided the type of crisis they've seen in Westchester and south of us. And so we stand ready to help. But my focus has been listening to the community health centers and hospitals who are telling me that they do not have enough of the masks and protective gear and ventilators we're going to need if we really get hit. And that's why it is so important that people all do their part. We can all do our part. Stay at home. Don't go out if you don't need to. Minimize your contact with other people. If a member of your family is sick, the whole family's got to stay home so we don't go spread it. That's why having some groceries in the house to last a week or two is important. You know, people could be checking in on their neighbors, people who are vulnerable or shut in. You can do that by phone or email. Remotely is the best way to do it. But, you know, we all got to look out for one another, and we have a role to play, because if each of us does the right things in terms of hand washing and social distancing, we will stop this virus in its tracks, and that will have an enormous benefit for all of us.
What are you hearing from constituents? I mean, people's everyday lives have been really upended here. You've got, college students coming back to live at home for the foreseeable future. Classes are going online. People who have been sent home from their jobs now. What's day-to-day life like for the average constituent in your district?
Well, look, obviously we're all in this together, and we're learning as we go. You know, my family is home. My family includes kids in college, kids out of college, and one in college. Everybody's had their life upended. We are cooking and sharing time as a family. We try to get out of the house and exercise to keep our sanity. We're getting a lot of projects done around the house, I can tell you that. From what I can tell, my neighbors and constituents are pretty much doing the same thing. We're the lucky ones, right? We're the ones who are not directly affected yet by this virus. Nobody in my household is ill, thank God. And for those that are, we want to make sure they get the support they need. And that is why the best thing the rest of us can do is stop spreading this virus so that there's enough capacity in the healthcare system to support those who have it. But I'll tell you, I do think people should realize that while this change is dramatic and sudden and sweeping, it will not go on forever. And while we're looking at certainly a period of many weeks, we are not looking at months and months and months. I do think that if we do the right thing right now, we can save ourselves from the worst of this epidemic, particularly in the Hudson Valley.
Last thing, Congressman, I have members of Congress in my headphones just about every day from around the Northeast, and they're all saying we got a really late start here in terms of this response. You had the White House sort of dismissing it as a hoax at the beginning. Are you now confident in the federal government's response in the task force that's being led by Vice President Mike Pence to deal with this going forward?
Well, look, there were unforgivable delays at the beginning, particularly in the diagnostics, the testing, and the other steps you need to take to head off the worst spread of the virus. But my focus right now is making sure the people I represent get everything they need in time to do us some good. The federal response is improving. I think at some of the agencies, there are good people who are working the problem as best they know how. People like Tony Fauci, I think, have enormous credibility, and I'm glad to see him front and center. And what I want to do is work in a bipartisan fashion to get people the economic help they need, alongside with supporting our first responders, our healthcare workers, and our hospitals and community health centers, so that we can treat the people who are sick. I am not here to carry anybody's water. I want to see results from these federal agencies. There are the Congress has put $8 billion in the pipeline to fight the virus and to provide help to our healthcare workers. The administration has to get that money out the door. That is an execution challenge. That is what an effective manager and an executive does, and that's what they've got to do, because we've only got one White House, we've only got one president, and he needs to be successful.
That's Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney of New York's 18th District. He's a Democrat. Congressman, thank you so much for taking some time during this wild period, and we'll check in with you soon.
Thank you. Everybody stay safe.
Vera Acurious Kelly is a Siena College professor and a regular guest on WAMC's roundtable panel. She was recently in Germany visiting family as the outbreak spread through Europe. She spoke with WAMC's Jim Lavoulis about her experiences in Germany, her travel back to the U.S., and how she's handling the pandemic as she battles cancer.
So I went to Düsseldorf, Germany, which is in North Rhine-Westphalia, the area that is most heavily affected by the coronavirus at this point in Germany. My older brother turned 60, and I had bought a ticket over spring break to go visit family members and celebrate my brother's birthday. So that was the original plan, and I flew out about a week ago. And my idea was just simply to see family and my brothers, my nieces and nephews, and sort of spend some time with family and seen for a little while. And all went well. We followed German governmental instructions on social distancing and really reduced our interactions with neighbors, people in the community. And then all of a sudden, President Trump made his announcement last week, Wednesday, in the evening, which, of course, was in the middle of the night in Germany, and said everybody needed to get out. You know, everybody, he would close borders. And as a German citizen who's married in the United States, I didn't quite know what that would mean for me. My husband tried to reach me at 3 a.m, but, of course, our phones were turned off. And so I woke up Thursday morning last week thinking, wow, I need to get back ASAP before the borders close. And my flight wasn't leaving. My originally scheduled flight wasn't leaving till Sunday. So we pretty much knew that the Sunday flight would likely be canceled. So my entire family became really actively involved in searching for a return option for me. I could have stayed in Germany, I guess, for weeks and months, but I really wanted to get back to my husband and my work here in the United States. So we called airlines on the phone. We tried to get a rebooking opportunity on the internet, but everything was overloaded. So my older brother came up with the idea to go to a travel agent in a small town nearby to see if we could find some other emergency ticket booked for the next day. So we went to the small travel agent. We found 4 open seats, not from the city of Düsseldorf, but from Frankfurt, which was a 3-hour car ride away. And my younger brother drove me to the airport. I booked that emergency ticket. It was really expensive, but it allowed me to come back Friday at 6 p.m. to Newark rather than, you know, after midnight, which would have been a huge problem.
Well, we certainly welcome you back stateside here. You mentioned social distancing, some of the measures that were taken. From what you were able to see, how did people in Germany respond to those measures in comparison to maybe what you've seen so far happening in the United States so far?
So there are a couple of differences I would have to point out. First of all, social distancing was implemented right away in Germany, and it was interesting to me to see how actually many more people in Germany followed instructions by their governmental agencies to pursue social distancing measures. The entire time I was home, I only saw my brothers and my sister-in-law. We did not include any younger people in our gatherings, or our walks outside only involved sort of more remote locations, not city environments. Many of the small restaurants had closed, deciding that it would be better and safer not to have guests in restaurants. And another really interesting measure was that families were encouraged not to bring children in contact with grandparents or older generations. So there was an immediate distancing between children who could possibly carry the virus and infect older or unwell relatives, right? So the idea was let's keep the generations apart to make sure we have a much lower infection rate and death rate, which in fact so far has worked out in Germany. Germany has, of course, over 10,000 infected members of society, but the death rate in Germany is quite low, among the lowest in all of Europe. While it is extremely tragic to lose people, the numbers have been kept very low. Now, the question I wanted to also respond to in terms of why is it that some societies are able to follow social rules and social expectations better than others. I think the Germans observed what was happening in Italy. Italians are very social people. They had larger social gatherings. They kiss each other on the cheek to greet each other. All of those observations were made in Germany, and people said, we can't be doing that, or we'll have the exact same scenario in Germany. So that's where social distancing was taken very seriously. In addition to that, governmental measures were followed, and Germans have, I believe, a higher trust in the accuracy of what their government officials say to them and follow instructions by health departments more closely than here in the United States.
And for our listeners who may not know, you are battling cancer. Now that you're back in the U.S., has your treatment been impacted at all?
So this was, in essence, one of the reasons why I really felt it was necessary for me to return. It would have been difficult to stay in Germany and then transition my healthcare, to Germany and find an oncologist, whereas here I was a well-established patient with NYOH, and I know my doctors and my nurses, and so basically one of the reasons I wanted to return and not run into difficulties was to access my healthcare options. So as soon as I returned, I followed a procedure and I called NYOH to find out what my options were. And initially, the office was very concerned because I got off an international flight and they didn't want to see me for weeks. And I insisted that they should since I didn't have symptoms. And I said, how about testing? And they, of course, said testing kits were not available. And so in the end, we negotiated through, and I apparently in one of the offices was the very first patient to come in after traveling internationally. So what we arranged for is that when I arrived, I would stay at least 6 to 8 feet away from anybody and just announce that I had arrived, that I would need a mask, and I was immediately asked to enter a conference room to my right, so I never entered any medical facility or clinic and it didn't endanger any other patients. And I was treated in that space. And I got injections and then I left right after that. So I was treated successfully, but it took a little bit of work to actually get the office to figure out its own protocols. I was surprised that the protocols had not been put in place already. So I feel actually that I helped that office figure out what they needed to do step by step by calling.
Throughout the development of this now global pandemic, we've heard about at-risk populations. Being that you are battling cancer, do you consider yourself at greater risk? And if you do, what would be your message to those in the community who aren't at risk and say, you know, I'm not going to 80% of people who contract this virus only have mild symptoms. So what's the big deal about?
Yeah, I mean, clearly everyone who undergoes cancer is an at-risk patient. So are people with heart disease, diabetes, or any other underlying health concern. So we are at risk, and it doesn't matter how old you are. If you have an underlying condition, you are at risk. And so The reason why I didn't see my nieces and nephews in Germany is because I am an at-risk person, and my nieces and nephews in Germany said, no, we can't. This time, Auntie Vera, we can't see you because it's very dangerous for you. So they understood that, but here in the United States, I must say, I believe that people are a little slow on the uptake. Now, I have a lot of great neighbors who understand very specifically what they can and cannot do, but they're paying very close attention to what this, what, for example, Dr. Fauci has explained in terms of flattening the infection curve so that people have access to health care when they need it and to not overload the hospital system or the emergency rooms. But what I was really surprised about were some of the images I've seen coming out of Florida in terms of people going to the beach or, you know, students, college students being on spring break and enjoying their own time, or New Orleans images where people are in Bourbon Street in large crowds and partying together. When they return home, they will be bringing home the infection to their own communities. And it is irresponsible. I find it shocking how thoughtless, apparently, some people are, not reflecting on what they will be doing to their own communities by importing the virus to their families and their neighborhoods. So, yes, I must call on everybody in their own communities to stay home. I, you know, was never put on quarantine by the health department, of course, but I self-quarantine in my house for that very reason. I don't want to be infected, and I certainly don't want to infect others. That is the only way for us to prevent massive death rates in the United States.
And Vera, in addition to being a panelist on WAMC's The Roundtable, you are a Siena College professor, and Siena College, like a number of colleges and universities across the Northeast, have adjusted their teaching schedules, in some cases shut down the campuses. Mm-hmm. What are you doing as it pertains to teaching students for this semester?
Yeah, so we are completely online. I have been in touch with a number of our students. We extended our spring break for all students to this week to make sure everybody can get settled at home and get their books and their materials ready and their internet access. So I have an opportunity to get training for online classes. I've been emailing with students, especially seniors who are finishing up honors theses or other research-based projects, and so we're in touch. We're trying to build up this opportunity to learn through online activities, and I'm very grateful because Siena has been incredibly well organized. We have a very good leadership giving clear instructions. Our information technology office has done convincing work reaching out to all faculty and students, getting them ready to go online. So I've been more than pleased with how Siena has handled the situation. Everyone's safety, health, and progress towards the end of the semester is foremost on our minds.
Vera Icarius-Kelly is a Siena College professor and a regular panelist on WAMC's The Roundtable. Vera, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much. Take care, Jim.
The pandemic has altered life for many people and businesses, especially the grocery industry. Jim also spoke this week with Mona Golub of the Golub Corporation, which operates about 130 Price Chopper, Market 32, and Market Bistro stores throughout the Northeast.
Relative to the changes that everyone has made in every area of life, we've come to recognize as one of the four kinds of business that remains open in crisis situations like this, supermarkets, pharmacies, gas stations, and health-related institutions. We play an incredibly important role in providing vital goods and services to our customers and to the communities that we serve. Every day, that's a good and manageable challenge for the last couple of weeks. So many factors and variables have changed that it's been a tremendous challenge that's required us to adjust our business almost on a daily basis to attempt to meet the express needs.
And I understand Price Chopper and Market 32 and Market Bistro as well have adjusted some store hours. Can you detail those and what other measures you have taken or are taking to keep up with demand?
Certainly. We have just adjusted our store hours for a second time. We are now officially closed between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. to the general public in order to be able to thoroughly clean and restock our shelves. Obviously, it's easier to do that, Jim, when there are fewer people in the store. By the same token, our merchandisers and buyers are working overtime to stay in contact with all potential sources of supply on the most high in demand items, as well as the other 25,000 items that are carried through the store, to ensure that as best we can meet the demand for all of the important categories. Most that have been talked about in recent days are non-foods, hand sanitizer and disinfectant wipes and some paper goods. As a general measure of reassurance, the food supply is not in jeopardy, although many products are being allocated or on allocation, as we say in our business, meaning that we're not getting 100% of what we're ordering, and therefore our stores are not necessarily getting 100% of what they need or would like to have. And that really kind of boils down to the fact that this crisis is so different from other emergency response events that we've dealt with over our 85 years of business and experience. You know, when you have an earthquake or a hurricane or a flood or even a big snowstorm, you're generally dealing with an isolated geographic area. And you can focus all attention, supply chain, energy on restoring that area. Well, in this case, we've got similar needs that are being expressed across our entire nation. So we really must be respectful, one state to the next, one chain to the next, one store to the next, one neighbor to the next, of what our individual needs are, because there is plenty to go around.
And I understand that in normal times, Price Chopper and Market 32 compete with the likes of Hannaford and Price Rite. But in these circumstances, are you in touch with those stores about stocking the necessary products or supply chain matters in general?
I think in terms of supply, we're working with manufacturers and consumer product good companies. And frankly, we've made some moves in recent days to bring products back in, certain brands that we had discontinued in recent years, simply because we want to get toilet paper on the shelves and paper towels on the shelves, ensuring that we have beef and chicken and milk and eggs and bananas and some key items that are continuing to run light. We are working to get supply, you know, quality supply from wherever we can. All of us within the industry are doing that. And yes, this is one of those times when we all hold hands together because we have a job to do and we have a role to fulfill. And we take that role very seriously.
And I understand this next question might be a little bit silly given everything, but are you able to provide any insight here on the reasoning behind the run on toilet paper amid this pandemic?
You know, I've talked to a number of customers and I've read quite a bit that's available on the subject. And it seems that it's more about self-affirmation and all of us, each of us, trying to take control of a situation where we really don't know necessarily what next week will bring. We don't have assurances in every respect that would help us make decisions that we only need so much of this or so much of that. Why toilet paper has become the symbolic item and why people may be buying, you know, 6 months of what they need or more, there's really not necessarily a logical explanation. Certainly it's an item that, you know, we all need. Unlike a run on water, where we forget that we have faucets in our homes and clean supplies of water, or hand sanitizer, where the medical experts are telling us that soap and water is at least as good, if not better, and there's plenty of soap. Sometimes, Jim, it's difficult to make logical decisions for ourselves when we're not quite sure where it is that we're going.
And Mona, you mentioned that obviously grocery stores are part of those four essential business categories staying open. And we talked about some of the adjusted store hours. I also understand Price Chopper, Market 32, Market Bistro are opening up early from 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. beginning on Thursday, just for senior citizens, that so-called at-risk category. What other measures are you doing to make sure your stores are safe? Are as safe as possible for shoppers and your workers?
Well, we've stepped up our sanitation protocols, which were high to begin with, and are following every direction and guideline that we're getting from the CDC. So we've got additional protocols that reinforce prevention from illness relative to cleaning high-touch areas more frequently. Obviously, the closing of our stores for certain periods of time allows us to do more thorough cleaning, both of the shelves as well as all of the areas across the store. And I think even more importantly than that, you know, people should understand that we're working closely with our department heads and supervisors to address the needs of any of our teammates who are personally impacted. And obviously, when schools close, parents are affected, and child care scenarios are affected. Folks who are taking care of parents are affected, and we need to be able to take a look at all of those cases on an individual basis and make sure that we're taking care of our own. So a lot of that is happening right now as we continue to monitor the number of cases in our marketing areas across our six-state footprint so that we understand what's happening and how we can react in a productive way. And that, you know, that is basically where our day-to-day has been. So we're focused on the changes as they're happening, all of the legislation that's being levied state to state, some because there isn't necessarily direction at the federal level that would make the operation in all of our states similar or consistent. We're reacting to each and every need and idea that's thrown our way.
And understanding that finances might not be at the top of mind for the grocery industry at this time, how has the past several days been for business?
It's been a bit hectic. Certainly, our support teams are working to ensure that we have all of the products that we can fuel through the stores to service the communities in need are working at high tilt. Clearly, our teammates at store level who are doing an absolute yeoman's job of dealing with the influx of more business than they usually deal with, having to clean more than usual, having to stock more than usual. It's been amazing to see them keep their spirits up and recognize the important role that we play and that they're playing for neighbors and friends. This is about a community pulling together to do what we need to do to get through these challenging times. And as we recognize that, it certainly is more about us taking care of each other than anything else.
Mona Golub of the Golub Corporation, which operates about 130 Price Chopper, Market 32, and Market Bistro stores throughout the Northeast. Mona, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thank you for listening. Our best to everyone who's in quarantine right now, who's just staying inside. Please stay safe and stay subscribed to the podcast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.